Hi, hello. We have a fun episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. We bounced around the league. Got some teams that are intriguing us. The Boston Celtics, now your 2 seed. Eyeball emoji. We talk about the non-Jaylen Brown participants right now. Derek White playing well, Peyton Pritchard playing well, the bench stepping up, the young guys playing well. It's a lot of fun happening in Boston. Not so much fun if you are facing the Detroit Pistons, though. We talk about how, even with injuries, they are still steamrolling folks. And then we have some questions. What do we make of some of the Houston lineups these days? What do we make of the Denver Nuggets with Jokic missing? What exactly is happening with Atlanta, and where is Trae Young going to be playing basketball next? How concerned should we be about the Oklahoma City Thunder? And finally, I tried to convince Steve that Rudy Gobert is good at basketball. And we talk about Unrivaled. Day one was fun. I was on the scene. We talk about some of our early observations. We hope you enjoy. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Woo! Let's talk some basketball, baby.
Let's talk some basketball, indeed. Plenty of hoop to get to. It's been an entertaining NBA weekend. Or since the last time we chatted, I am currently in an undisclosed location in Miami, down here for the first week of Unrivaled Basketball. We'll have some Unrivaled takeaways a little bit later in the pod. We start with the NBA side, Steve, and I kind of wanted to go big picture. I wanted to bounce around overall as we roam the baseline, but I wanted to go big picture because we are fresh off an episode in which, towards the end, we talked about the season that Jaylen Brown is having. The bucket getting, the improved playmaking. I kind of just want to zoom out with Boston as a whole. Because now, as of recording, 23-12. They're second in offense, 15th in defense, fourth in net rating overall in the league. They are now the 2 seed in the Eastern Conference, Steve. This has gone from early in the year. There's some good concept stuff happening. The need to get the defense to a certain level. They're losing close games. To here's this win streak. But what does this mean? Now they're kind of in like that 4-6 range. To now they're 3.5 back of Detroit, who keeps winning. And I'm sure we're going to talk a little bit about Detroit today. So before even getting into the things that I've enjoyed, I would just pose this question to you, Steve. Is it time to kind of shift from this is a house money season, see what you got, to the Celtics are serious contenders in the Eastern Conference and we should take them more seriously within that context of the conversation?
I think that question would offend Joe Mazzulla to no bounds, because
understood.
The second part of what you said is what we've been doing this whole time. Mm-hmm. They've embraced the process this whole year. This is what we were drawn to in the preseason. In the buildup was Joe Mazzulla is a madman. This team competes. Jaylen Brown has a chance to do something special. All of those things were happening. So if you, Joe Mazzulla never saw this as house money. This is a lot of work that they put in to get to this point, to an identity and put themselves in this position. And so what I would say is you just keep doing what you're doing. So I'll buy into the house money concept a little bit, because there's nothing you need to change. You just need to continue to work. This is a formula for this season that is working for you. Why change anything else? You don't need to disrupt a single thing. We know exactly how much weight is on Brown, Derek White, Peyton Pritchard, Anthony Simons to score baskets. And we know the rotation is there for everyone else to contribute and compete. And when those players are contributing to winning basketball and you know exactly what you're going to do every single night and you're having success with it, now there's more buy-in into this process. There's more competition. There's more effort that's put through. You don't need to touch a thing here. You need to just continue to put the work in. That's where I'm at with Boston.
Okay. I think that's fair. And I think, again, as two of us who were pretty high on what Boston could be this year, I certainly didn't see top 3 seed. And so I think there was like a house money element to this because of the Tatum context. But like even for my own expectations, like I just did not foresee this being the high end for them. I thought high end was just going to be playoff spot. They get 5 or 6 and then we have the Tatum conversation later in the year. The fact that they are like firmly in the top 3 right now. Again, just past New York in the standings with Jaylen Brown playing at this MVP type level, or at least at a level that puts him in the conversation to be on ballots. I'm just like, hey, man, that salute to everyone involved. So certainly don't want to offend Joe Mazzulla and those in the locker room that have been working towards this.
I don't think you meant to offend Joe Mazzulla. I'm just telling you he would be offended by you saying that because, yeah, we've been a contender. What do you mean? Now, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. One, great timing on their part because the New York Knicks have once again found the cycle of, hey, man, teams really sure are being physical and tough against us. And also, our defense isn't as good as it was. We've lost 4 straight games. And, oh, yeah, Detroit can't stand us. But I think for Boston, it ties back into what we were talking about last week. Having an identity and trusting that will guide you through the regular season. I will say this once. I will say it twice. I will say it every single pod until the end of time, probably. This is my favorite part of the year, Nikias. This is where you really get into the meat and potatoes of the season for me. Mm-hmm. We're about to get into the next portion where we're going to sprint to the All-Star break. That's going to happen after that. It's going to be a double sprint. But this is where, okay, who are we? What do we do? How do we figure out how to get back to it? So many of these teams with these standings are being tested on a nightly basis. So many of these teams, how many teams do you look up and they've won 4 out of the last 10 games? 5 out of the last 10 games. Because this is the hard part of the season. Because you are having to go through the grind and you are having to do what you do well, knowing teams know that you're trying to do it, and you lose yourself a little bit. So can we get back to what we do offensively? The Orlando Magic can alternate between being a great clutch offense team and being a, hey, what are you guys doing team? And you never know which side you're going to get. And that's the beauty of it. The Philadelphia 76ers can go on the run they've gone on and then face the Denver Nuggetless Nuggets and lose at home. This is the fun part of the season. And I don't get why people don't understand that.
Well, Steve, I think to bounce off of that quickly before circling back to Boston in particular, I think there's just a lot of angst in basketball discourse these days. Nobody ever wants to see their team lose unless you're at the bottom of the standings and you want to see your team lose because you want the chance to get one of these top 3 in this year's draft class. But you get the general point. And so when you see something that, ooh, this don't feel great, and then you lose 3 out of 5 because teams are dinging the thing that doesn't feel great while some of your other rivals are playing well, then it's like, ah, none of this feels very good. I don't like this. I am unhappy. It's hard to see the overall beauty of all these teams are battling, all these teams are fighting challenges, et cetera, when your team is just in the thick of it and you're facing losses. Like, I think we're going to talk about the Thunder a little bit later, so I'm not going to hang here too long. But I think for the Thunder, you're 6-6 in your last 12. I've seen some of the Thunder fan angst on Twitter where it's like Shea post-game is very even-keeled, as he always is. And it's like, hey, I'm tired of hearing this. Y'all need to do better. It's like, yeah, but like also they're still like on a 70-win pace right now. We can relax. So it's hard to separate those two.
I get it, but here's the thing. If you're having angst right now, you're going to be stressed out the rest of the season.
That's probably true.
Who's feeling good right now? You tell me what fan base feels good today. Which one?
I would say the Boston Celtics for sure.
Detroit? That's 2.
Detroit mostly. Because there has been...
Look me in my eyes. Look me right here. Uh-huh. Right here. If you were the Detroit Pistons fan and you were unhappy, I'm so sorry. You should enjoy this season. Continue.
Oh, no. I just say, like, there's been a Star Thompson conversation, Jaden Ivey conversation, those kind of things. The overall, to your point, the overall feeling is happiness because of how good they've been. But I'm just saying, like, the approval rating is not 100
that's fine,
in Detroit.
That's fine, that's all we got 2, right?
We got 2.
So who else can we get? Can we get to 5?
Can we get to 5? Like, surely Philly.
Until they just lost to the Denver Nuggets.
They did just lose. But yes, it's just like, hey, we're still having this season while working Embiid, PG into it, et cetera, et cetera. The Spurs?
I'll put them up there.
It has to be a yes.
I'll put them up there, but it wasn't fun last week.
That is probably fair. That's probably fair. I think top of the list overall, Steve, Phoenix Suns.
Okay, we got the 5. We did it.
I think Phoenix certainly has to be up there. But to your point, the fact that we had to have a whole, like, who are the 5 out of 30, I think it makes your point, even as we get there.
That's all I wanted to say. Just want to throw it out there. Also, real quick, before you continue to bounce around, can we give a salute to the Detroit Pistons for what they are And to be able to have that win against New York, which, boy, they wanted that rematch, but no Jalen Duren, no Tobias Harris, no problem. Hey, mm-hmm. we play Cleveland. Here's Danis Jenkins. Hey, here's a whole bunch of Cade Cunningham. Here's a Sar Thompson defensively. The identity of the Pistons has lifted them throughout this entire season. And so you shouldn't sit there and call them a fraud. They have earned their spot at the top of the Eastern Conference, and they've held their spot. And you have to understand, like, the most fun part about the Detroit Pistons season, they go with their starting lineup. If there's injuries, J.B. Bickerstaff points to Duncan Robinson and says, fly off a bunch of screens. And then you get to a point where it's Cade, and they start putting the dogs out there. They start letting the dogs out. Here comes Isaiah Stewart. Here comes Ron Holland. Here's Devontae Green. Here's Jaden Ivey. We're going to have the dogs out there. And the dogs continue to compete throughout the game. And I just love the dynamic that they know who they are, they trust who they are, and they compete every single night. And that feels like a team that you shouldn't sit there and be like, oh, they're a fraud. No, they've won 13 home games. They've won 13 road games because they do what they do on a nightly basis. They put their paws on you. Kay Cunningham cooks, and you have to deal with them for 48 minutes.
No, I'm right there with you. Because I think, and we've talked through this on the pod before, like, I don't have any questions about this Detroit defense. Like, I don't think you have many places to poke at. And even if you feel like you do, they have so many athletes that can roam around behind actions, like the big room in general, like as we wait for Jalen Duren to get back and stay healthy. Like, the fact that you can lose Jalen Duren for a little bit and the recourse is, hey, how about more Isaiah Stewart, who's just been defending at an all defense level again? And I do hope he hits the minutes threshold so he can actually make one of these teams, because he's been good enough the last year and a half. Like, you have him. Then it's like, okay, well, cool. Let's just go double big with him and Paul Reed. You feel like you pick at Paul Reed in action, you got to deal with Isaiah Stewart. You put Isaiah Stewart in action, you're probably not getting anything good. And you're also taking pressure off of Paul Reed, just using him as a helper in that regard. You still have Asar digging this hound, folks. And then on the other end, Cade Cunningham continues to level up. The finishing is better. The interior craft is better. The foul drawing is better. The playmaking seems more solid for him. Turnovers cutting down a little bit. Still keeping an eye on the three-point shooting, but he's not afraid to take the pull-ups. And on the nights that he has the pull-ups going, oh no. But then here are all these other creators, Steve, that can just kind of fill in. Like, I'm glad you hit on the Duncan Robinson point in particular, because it is very funny, and I think you tweeted about this. Somebody goes down, okay, cool, we're just going to run like 15, 20 off-ball actions for Duncan Robinson tonight. Let's see what you do with it. And like, watching the Knicks game in particular, and I wish I could remember the account that tweeted it, because I was thinking and I saw the tweet and I was like, ooh, I got to make sure I highlight this on the pod. So my apologies. If you see it, comment in the YouTube section. I'll give you your props on the next pod. But it was like, Duncan Robinson kind of changes the matchup against New York, because normally, hey, we're going to put Jalen Brunson on insert shooter here. They're not going to put the ball on the floor like that. It's fine. With Duncan Robinson, you don't have the same luxury because you have the shooting threat, and like, where they're starting him in some of these actions puts more strain on the defense, depending on how Detroit spaces around that. And then it's like, Duncan can put the ball on the floor. A little bit of finishing, or I can just kind of keep the train going with connect the passing and go that way. And it's like, oh, Steph, well, we have another way to put Jalen Brunson in action now, if we're just looking at that matchup in particular. But overall, you still have that variety that you can lean into. And then you go to the bench, it's like, oh, well, here's Danis Jenkins again. Here's all the buck again. I have had so much fun with this Danis Jenkins season.
Hey, you don't have to, if you stay ready, you don't have to get ready.
That's, yeah, that's very true. And so, like, yeah, my overall angst was, hey, what is this half-court offense going to look like against really good defenses? The season goes on, like, they're now, I think, 9th in offensive rating per clean the glass. Like, it's gotten better. I'm just like, okay.
I mean,
if they can find enough.
Well, I was going to say, I understand the offensive concerns, but I think, when have you felt like Detroit doesn't know what they want to do? Everyone wants to talk about how the spacing is so bad, but you can generate spacing with empty side pick and rolls, or attacking matchups, or putting a guard in the dunker spot. There's different things you can do to kind of tweak and poke at teams. Mm-hmm. They have movement. Sometimes it's slower than you would want, but they've never not felt like they're in control of what they want to do offensively. I think that's mm-hmm. so important in today's NBA, especially with defenses trying to poke at you, especially this time of year. Detroit just kind of knows, okay, we don't do this. We can't do this. We will do that. And so mm-hmm. we're going to drive if we get something. We're going to defend, get in transition. And so it's just a formula for success. And I think there's a self-awareness about this team that you don't always see in today's NBA. Mm-hmm. That we know exactly what we are. even if we have our flaws, we'll figure those out. You have to deal with all the things we bring to the table. Mm-hmm. That's music strength.
No, I think that's the very key point there. Just that overall self-awareness, it ties into the grit that you've talked about, the overall buy-in that they have with this group that extends from last year where they make the playoff leap. And now they are even better than a lot of people anticipated, both ends of the floor. So Detroit deserves their flowers. Stranglehold still on the one seed. Felt like the Knicks were catching up, and then we had to slide again. We'll talk about them a little bit later. Can I circle back to Boston very quickly?
Sure, man.
Because I am just having a lot of fun. I mentioned earlier, second in offense overall. We talked about Jaylen Brown, so I'll set him to the side a little bit. He continues to be very, 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 very good. Check out the last episode of Dunk Spot if you want more Jaylen Brown-specific commentary there. But the way that they strain defenses, Steve, is so fun. And that's where I am glad it has not just been the Jaylen Brown show. And we go as he goes, and if he doesn't have it, then we're in trouble. Alluded to it on the last episode, but naturally it was a Jaylen Brown segment. Derek White is just playing so much better. Mm. Celtics 8-2 in their last 10. Mm-hmm. Derek White averaging over 21 points per game, 5 boards, 6 assists during the stretch. Also, do you want a fun stat on Derek White,
Steve? Absolutely.
So, filtered it for the last 10 games for Boston. So, since December 15th, he is one of 9 players averaging at least 2 blocks per game during that stretch. It's 8 bigs in him. He is averaging more blocks than Victor Wembanyama during this stretch.
Oh.
That's not how that's supposed to work. His weak side stuff has been so good.
Okay.
For pretty much all year long. Like, my issue, if you want to call it that, was like the early stretch for Derrick White. He just could not knock down shots from the perimeter. And some of them fell a little early in the clock. It's like, hey, man, we got to get you get these rolling. That's been better. The defense has been pretty darn good all year long. Okay. And so, like, watching some of the low man rotations he's been able to make, and even some of the on ball stuff, because I also appreciate that going back to the early Boston days or even the late San Antonio days, as he is someone that can slide with a drive and get those kind of on ball blocks. It's not easy for a guard to do. But like, his 2-way impact has been incredible. But to the offense point, it's similar to the Jaylen Brown thing, to where they are using so much off-ball movement and particular spacing alignments to put stress on defenses. So you still have these flares. Derrick White fits into those. Peyton Pritchard can fit into those. Anthony Simons, when he checks in, he can fit into those. And it's just giving them such easy reads. Also because their bigs are such good screeners, Steve. Nemhias Kata, one of the best screeners we have in the league. Luka Garza, very good screener, who I've really enjoyed the Luka Garza experience, at least on offense. Wow. Keeping the brow raised on defense.
Wow.
He's working.
I enjoyed it. I get you. Continue.
Well, here's the thing. Like, if it was actually just God awful, he wouldn't be in the rotation at all. Mm. You know what I mean? So, like, he has certainly done enough to hold up. But I'm saying that most of my enjoyment has come from what the offense has looked like. But because those guys can flare him out, it's easy catch and shoot reads for Derek White and these other guards. Or I can just attack immediately. Or if I don't have it, now it's a pick and roll with one of these great screeners. And then they're just able to get headway because of how great these screens are. And now you get into some of the floaters from Derek White, some of the finishes, some of the late kicks, some of the pull-ups from Peyton Pritchard, especially if those are higher pick and rolls up the floor. And so you get that stuff. Steve, as you have known me for many years at this point, you know I am a huge proponent of Spain pick and roll. The Boston Celtics run it more than
on. It's stacked. Come on.
Listen, Mama called the stack up. Yeah, I'm sorry. Anyway. But to that end, no team runs it more than the Boston Celtics. No team runs it more efficiently than the Boston Celtics. For the track of data that we have, league average for Spain pick and rolls or stacked pick and rolls per second spectrum, about 1.12 points per possession. Boston is over 1.5.
Oh, my.
That is not how that is supposed to work.
Okay.
And so, like, I love the action. Boston's doing a good job of running it. But, like, the fact that they are so interchangeable between who is handling and who is setting that bat screen has been a lot of fun. It's a lot of Jaylen Brown as the bat screener. And if he's handling it, Derek White will set it. Peyton Pritchard will set it. Sam Hauser will set it. And you just don't know who. And even with that, it's not just going to be, all right, guys, we're bringing the ball up the floor. Let's just run it. You don't know what kind of fluff they're running beforehand to kind of disguise it before flowing into their variations of stack. So, like, that's been a lot of fun. And even quickly bouncing off the Sam Hauser point and just the overall spacing for Boston, Sam Hauser doing the, like, Eric Gordon in Houston thing to where I'm just going to spot up 35 feet from the basket and see what you do with it has been a lot of fun. And like that sets up one, you gotta have to account for him because he's not afraid to pull from 30. But beyond that, if it's early offense, here's like a wide pin now for him to dart into that you're not prepared for at the angle that he's coming at. And that's a movement three for him, or he could put the ball on the floor a little bit. Like there was a possession against the Sacramento Kings. Boston wins that game. Like a transition bit. Nemias Cater and Sam Howes on the left side of the floor. Cater gets down first. And you would think Sam Howes either spots up at the wing or just completely feels the left corner. He just stops at the hash. It's not like technically a flare, but like the way that he timed it and when he stops, it kind of feels like a flare. He gets at the hash. Trying to remember who the defender was. Like, oh, snap, that's Sam Hauser. Pump fake, one dribble, pull up three, and he catches it. I'm just like, hey, man, you're not supposed to be able to stress out defenses that far out that early in the clock.
Do you want to do a Steve stat on
yes.
Sam Hauser?
Sure.
The Celtics are 12-3 when he attempts seven or more field goals this season. Mm. Is that anything?
But no, that's good stuff. But no, it's also funny that Sam Hauser is once again doing the first 3 weeks of the season, will you ever make a three? And then you just stop missing threes altogether. Like, that's a very good bit for me. Did it last year. Through October and November, and he's heating up once again. And so, like, just watching all of these guys contribute the way that they have, even down to the rookie slash young wings. Hugo Gonzalez continues to defend his tail off. If you don't track him, he's cutting. And if you don't track him when the shot goes up, he's getting an offensive rebound. Jordan Walsh, same thing.
Okay.
Not down shots from the corner. If you don't track him, he's cutting. If you don't track him when the ball goes up, he's getting an offensive rebound. A combined or nearly three offensive rebounds between the two per game over the last 10, which has been fun. Also, some of these Jordan Walsh drives, Steve, have been intriguing to me.
I think the funniest part about this is, one, we were bouncing around and this turned into a full-on Boston Celtics.
They've been so good.
But here's the thing. This is what they've done all season long. And so every lineup they have makes sense because of the roles they've put these guys in. There's opportunity to compete. When you look on the floor and you see Derek White and you see Jordan Walsh and you see Hugo Gonzalez and you see Luka Garza and you see Sam Hauser, that makes sense. Everyone knows what they're supposed to do. Everyone does their job. Everyone reacts accordingly. Everyone knows. My favorite bit with the Boston season has been mm-hmm. the nights where they don't compete. And I flip back to the Boston game and I see Luka Garza is in. And I'm like, oh, I know exactly what's happened. And I know exactly what Joe Mazzulla is trying to fix. But like, it ties back to identity, Nikias. It ties back to belief. It ties back to understanding how we win and how we have success and keeping pressure on you. Peyton Pritchard went in there. It didn't have the most fun against the Clippers. I know Clippers fans are not happy with Peyton Pritchard.
They are not. Get well soon, DJ.
But boy, I tell you, that game got out of hand. He said, it's time to Aura Farm. I'm going to get all these buckets that I didn't make, and I'm leaving. And like, they just get it. They're aligned. So it's been fun to watch. Did you have any other teams you want to bounce around, or did you have more Boston thoughts? I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, you're good. I had a very quick Peyton Pritchard thing, and then I did want to bounce around in earnest. Boston has just been very good. I want to give them their flowers.
I understand.
The playmaking for Peyton Pritchard is something that I'm keeping an eye on. He seems more in control in ball screens. It's the basic stuff. Again, here's a guy off a flare. I can make that basic pass. You get assists that way. It's like six assists to like 1.2 turnovers over his last 10. So that stuff's been good. Anytime he's gotten two on the ball, I'm just kind of tracking the nuance that he's playing with that. Whether it is a full-blown, like the Chicago game, we just put two on the ball anyway, or we're switching, but we kind of got two right here. He's done such a good job of, okay, I'm going to string it out this time. Next time, I'm going to try to split it. Next time, I'm going to just hit the roller immediately. Next time, I'm going to make this skip. Next time, I'm just going to make the relief pass. Like, he is making the reads. I'm not going to say he's like an A-plus pass or anything like that, but when he is that kind of bucket getter, any playmaking growth you get on top of that, it just feeds into more confidence and things for you, more usage, more responsibility. So I've enjoyed that part of the Peyton Pritchard process as of late. So just wanted to sprinkle that one in. So quickly for me, Steve, as we bounce around, we had a mailbag episode the week of Christmas, and we were asked about the Portland Trailblazers. Like, hey, how we feel about Tiago Splitter? How are we feeling about Portland's offense, the late game offense in particular? I just wanted to quickly say, Portland Trailblazers, as of recording, 5-1 in their last six games. They are kind of torching the Nets right now offensively, which has been cool. They're 3-0 in their last three, they're 3-0 in their last few clutch performances. A 128 offensive rating in the clutch during those three games, which again, clutch sample size is already small. Three games of clutch time is also super small. but they are getting buckets. It feels more organized. Denny Avdija continues to play at a very high level. And like the playmaking for him also starting to pop. I think just in general, the playmaking feels better. Turnovers are down. That's kind of like the big bugaboo with him offensively so far this year. He's knocking down threes at a higher clip than he ever has. The drives, he drives more than virtually anyone. It's been between him and Shape in terms of like total drives and drives per game all year long. So he's doing that. The fact that he's cutting down these turnovers, he's seeing two on the ball, he's handling that better. And then we get to some of the conservative coverages that he's getting. And now he's just like, well, I'll just step into threes now on top of this. He feels more willing to take those. Like, that can shift how teams defend him. And I wonder what that ends up opening up for Portland overall. And so I want to shout out what they're doing offensively, and just they are now back in the play-in picture firmly as they went on this little run. Shade Sharp, up and down in terms of the scoring, but like I'm starting to feel a little bit better about his offensive process at the very least. Donovan Clingan remains one of the more underrated impact players that we have in the league. Insane defensively. Portland's a different team when he's not on the floor. And offensively, it's still the ball crushing screens. Some of like the short roll passes have really popped for me as of late. And we saw some flashes during his rookie year as well. So it's not necessarily new, but it's like, huh, it feels like more of these. Also taking nearly 4 threes a game over this little stretch, last 5 games, knocking them down. Teams still aren't going to be afraid of him yet, but I'm just continuing to track how many of those he shoots, especially with him being stashed above the breaker on the wing as often as he is to kind of set up some of these ball screens and stuff. Caleb Love knocking down all kinds of shots right now.
Oh, no, it's time to talk about Caleb Love. It's time to talk about Caleb Love. The time is now. I enjoyed so many of the Caleb Love minutes, and I'd be like, ooh, he kind of cooking. And I would go and look at the shooting splits, and I'd be like, ooh.
And bad.
Boy, he's still cooking, but also, that has changed.
Yes.
That has changed. The fact that he's been aggressive, he's been disruptive on defense, he's attacked on offense, and he's making shots, and that becomes a more complete player. There's a point, I believe, prior to last night's game, he had averaged 17 points over 7 games, shooting 47 from the field, 43% from three. He's the third fastest player in Trailblazers history to reach 50 career three-pointers made, and the fastest since Damian Lillard, who did it in 23 games in 2012-13. And that's Caleb Love. And that's the kind of player you need to pick up during this kind of stretch and be able to have a windfall. And so Shaedon Sharpe, I think him and Keyonte George, the only people of a certain age to average 20 points a night. Like, they are putting things together and understanding who they are, and I've enjoyed watching them play.
Yeah, that's good stuff. That's good stuff. Tubani Kamara shooting 41% from three on nearly 8 attempts over the last 5 games. He continues to hit threes. I'm just like, hey, man.
Do you believe in it, though? Because you got mad at you liked him shooting more. And then you got mad at the volume because he was shooting worse, and now you're happy about it. So where are you at with Tumani Kamara shooting threes?
Okay, well, let's clarify. I was not mad at him for taking threes. Let's pause there.
Okay, my fault. I apologize.
No, you're good. I think actually just kind of broaden the scope of the conversation. We've had these discussions about like what 3-point shooting and volume and efficiency, like what the blend actually means for defenses. And so for me, it is cool to see players shooting 38% from three, 40% from three, 41% from three, whatever the case may be. If you're doing it on 3 attempts, I'm just like, okay, that's neat. Can you raise the volume? More so because a player that is taking 2 or 3 threes a game at a high clip, defenses aren't like, we got to run this guy off the line. They're living with these. And so that's where I want to see, okay, can you get from 3 to 4? Can you get from 4 to 5? That kind of thing. And so with Tumani, the 3-point shooting has intrigued me because teams still are largely like, you can have this, big dog. And so the fact that he is taking more in light of that, and like during this stretch, shooting 40% from three on high volume now, that's where I'm like, can you continue to stack that? Like, I think we are still a ways away from teams saying, okay, this is now just him. And so now we have to treat him a certain way. But like, in order to get to that point, you have to take a requisite amount. And so that's where like, okay, I'm intrigued. So to your question, do I believe in it? I'm believing more in it. I'm still not there yet.
Understood.
But I'm just like, okay, this is intriguing. Like, the willingness is a positive for me. So that's where I'm just like, okay, let's see what Tumani's got for us. Because, like, the defense is going to pop. And so I remember we got a question a while back about Tumani's shot versus his drives and what would be more impactful for his growth moving forward. And I think I answered that it's going to be the shot. But the drives do still loom pretty large. Because if he does shoot well enough to get more coverage from the perimeter, he's going to have to beat those closeouts. Can I give you a quick Tumani stat, Steve?
Yes.
178 players have logged at least 100 drives so far this year, Steve, at least as of recording. In terms of points per possession generated on those drives, Tumani Kamara, 163rd. That can't beat a bit.
Okay.
And so, again, like, do I think it's impossible? No, he has the frame. Like, he's put on some, he's put some interesting stuff on film. It's just got to be a level of consistency. Can get the handle tighter? Can he use the body better? Like, he has some shoulder bumps in there. You know, I think it could come. But, like, you're going to need that to accompany the shooting if the shooting is indeed real. So that's kind of where I wanted to land there. But, like, I still love Tumani.
Understood.
Okay. Well, with that, we will take a quick break. And when we return, we have some more teams to bounce around. Some good teams that are showing some interesting things on film. How real is it? Do we have some questions? Do we have some peeves? We're also going to talk about Trae Young because we've got to talk about Trae Young. Stay tuned.
The NBA YouTube channel is live. The smartest NBA coverage on YouTube 5 days a week. Watch a Dunker Spot with Nekias Duncan and myself. Elite Hoops Talk, great X's and O's conversations. Kevin O'Connor giving you that deep analysis and the sharpest hoops conversations you can find in the land. Every week, Tom Haberstroh and Dan Devine will be breaking down the stats that define the league on the big number. And plus, you get fast daily NBA updates and trends from Dan Titus to keep you ahead of the timeline. If you love basketball, welcome home.
And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. Quick apologies, dealing with a little bit of technical issues on my end. So we apologize. We're going to push through the second half of the pod. We'll be good to go for the next episode. But Steve, sad to bounce around a little bit more. Some teams that make us think. Some teams that have us raising our brow. Who's top of mind for you right now?
I will take us to the Western Conference, and I've been thinking about the Denver Nuggets here for a little bit. Obviously, they have had the injuries. Nikola Jokic out, Jonas Valanciunas out, Christian Brown, Aaron Gordon back in, and then they were not there. No one was there against Philadelphia, and then they won. And so, very quickly, shout out to the Nuggets for winning that game. Shout out to head coach David Adelman for being a hell of a coach and being able to find a way to tap into that team, get everyone to contribute to winning basketball, and understand how good of a coach he is. But I've been thinking, how do the Nuggets push through and survive this stretch without Nikola Jokic? Because it's going to be key. This is the Western Conference. It's unforgiving. And so if you are thinking about Denver, you're thinking they may slide. They may fall into the play-in or whatever. Doomsday, I don't think they hit that. But they are going to have to navigate different things during this stretch. And so if you're a team that's game-planning against Denver, your game plan's a lot different. For Denver, your attack has to be a lot different. You have to figure out how to be yourself in a different vacuum, in a different box. More teams are going to switch against the Denver Nuggets. And then if I'm a team, why not fully game plan for Jamal Murray in a way that, hey, yeah, we always talk about trying to limit what you're doing. We always talk about getting you attention. But we're going to up that ante. And I think the Brooklyn Nets showed exactly, hey, man, this is not going to be fun for you in theory. You know, we're going to be up. We're going to be trapped. We're going to switch. We're going to go switch and double. And I think what happens is, what do you open up if you're the Denver Nuggets? Can you create an advantage and can you keep an advantage? And that's a question we haven't had to ask about this team for the majority of the time. And if you did, it was usually in the, what most people like to call the non-Jokic minutes. But now they have to do that consistently. And so they have other initiators. Like, they're not afraid to have Peyton Watson bring the ball up, Christian Brown bring the ball up, Bruce Brown bring the ball up. You put Jamal Murray off ball, but does that empower a defense to be physical and deny and push him around and try and bog you down that way? If I'm a defense against Denver Nuggets right now, my goal is to push you deeper in the clock by default. And I think it's interesting, like, Denver was trying to navigate, okay, where do we get him the ball to make this more effective in real time? They were almost using Jamal Murray as a hub at the elbow, just trying to get him around in different places. And now what I will say is, Denver did adjust in the second half and they ran pick and roll, and Nets were switching, and then they cleared a wing and said, okay, the early help you're showing,
no more of that.
The taking away the driving lanes you're showing, you can do it, but it will now be late. Jamal Murray will be in the paint by the time that you show this help. I think that's huge. Jamal Murray's gonna have to, he's gonna have to carry a torch during this program. Like, it's, I know it's the Fresh Prince of Bel Air looking around and no furniture around, but hey, he's gonna have to figure it out. One thing that popped for me, right? Jamal Murray leads the Nuggets in drives per game, about 12.8, mm-hmm. right? Everyone else, if you look at drives per game for the Nuggets, everyone else is like four below. It's something you don't consider because they cut so much, but when you see it,
they're one of the lowest driving teams in the league all year.
In the three games with Jokic out, Jamal Murray's averaging 18.7 drives mm-hmm. per game. That number would be second in the NBA for the season. And almost, last time I checked, a full drive more than Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. So that's going to put a lot of pressure on Jamal Murray to find a way to create. Now, I've always said the drives from him were important, but now they get to a different level. They get to a higher level. It's crazy. What I will say that helps Denver is the return of this version of Aaron Gordon. And I very specifically mean this version of Aaron Gordon. And I know you might have a twinge of concern that he may do too much, but it was good early and they need it now. Because I think the fact that he can and is empowered to do different things offensively, like this is not just Aaron Gordon screener, Aaron Gordon dunker spot. No, this is Aaron Gordon attacks. I can attack matchups. I can do all of these things and mm-hmm. I can get buckets. They're going to need all of that. And so being able to mix in his attacks, use him as a screener, that puts them in a different scenario. And I it was very funny. I was watching the Brooklyn game. Shout out to Sarah Kustak because she was like, boy, it's neat that they haven't really put Aaron Gordon at the five right away. And then fast forward, the Nuggets put Aaron Gordon back at the five because they had to figure things out. So because I laughed. I was like, oh, that's cool. I'm glad they didn't do that. But no, they got to put him there. Can they figure that portion out? I think they have enough. I think they have a belief in what they do. But now your defense becomes even more important. And how much wiggle room do you have on that end of the floor? Can you compete consistently? Are you going to keep the ball in front? Are you able to rotate? Like, you put Holmes in. He's more active on defense. But that activity now puts you directly back into, boy, you need to show early help. You need to close mm-hmm. back out. You got to rotate. You got to keep the ball in front. So they've just got to figure out how to continue to be themselves. But I think everyone's bought in, like Spencer Jones. But Spencer Jones, my unofficial cousin, is just a basketball player, man. Forget how the shot looks. That guy just does little things every single night. You should enjoy watching Spencer Jones play basketball. The fact that he went again and gets against Brooklyn and screened for Jamal Murray, realized they were switching, and then screened his own mm-hmm. man as he rolled, like, come on, man. Like, you don't just do stuff like that by accident. So I've just been thinking about the Nuggets for a little bit.
I like that. I think to circle back to the offense first with Denver, I'm glad you highlighted the drives in particular because, as you mentioned, hey, if Jamal Murray's feeling good, he's getting downhill. If he's not feeling good, he might not be getting downhill as much as you like. And now without Jokic, you just need a figurative and literal driver of good offense, and he can provide that for you. It has been interesting to me, kind of neat, but more so interesting watching who else picks up the mantle of, oh, I need to attack more too. I think, to your point, this is where Aaron Gordon is very important. He was very rude to the Brooklyn Nets rookies in particular in that basketball game with the drives and some of the post-ups. But Peyton Watson has looked at this opportunity like, bet, let me show you what I can do. And it is a very volatile situation, notably. You are seeing, oh, he does have a little bit more of a handle than you thought. He is not afraid to throw his body into someone else's. There's like a smidgen of foul drawing craft. I'm just like, okay, when he does decide to slow down during some of these drives, he has some stuff. When he does not, you know, we just keep watching for, you know, it's a growth area. We'll keep tracks up. But like during these four games, he's averaging over 20. And a lot of that has been because of downhill attacking, particularly in transition. Like, I have really enjoyed the transition attacks from him. And so, like, it's been cool watching him step into more of that role. Less of the driving, but you know, similar to the Duncan Robinson bit we mentioned a little bit earlier, Tim Hardaway Jr. is like, oh, bet, you need more from me? Do I need to be more aggressive in this context? I think I'm okay with doing that. That's cool. One guy I did want to highlight, more so popped in the Philly game, but kind of been a quiet undercurrent of, like, the youth of the Nuggets portion of the program. Welcome back, Jalen Pickett. I am glad he's looking at the basket because, like, he can score. He can put the ball in the hoop. I think for most of his minutes, it's been very much, how can I get this ball from point A to point B when I am in? I don't know when I'm going to be in because, you know, you add Bruce Brown, he can play make for you, get the hybrid units with Jamal Murray leading the second unit and stuff like that. So, like, not sure when I'm going to get like consistent runs. When I do, let me make sure I get the ball to insert player that is better than me. And so to see the Philly game, it's like, oh, well, I really don't have a choice but to kind of be myself. And it's, hey, here's a jumper against the switch. Here's a pull-up against drop. Here's a drive. Here's another drive. Here's another drive. It's like, Jalen, as a basketball fan, please bottle that. It's not going to be, what was it, 27-5-9 or whatever the stat line was. It's not going to be that every night. But that consistent aggression, like, I think he can tap into some stuff and help grease the wheels of this offense. So, like, I am keeping an eye on what he's going to look like in this context as well. And so I do think it's going to be, in terms of taking pressure off of Jamal Murray, I would like to see more of those elbows catches. So at the very least, he's a dribble away from a paint touch or a rim attempt if necessary. Can unlock some of the playmaking there. Like, one of the things that tripped me out during the stretch, they're still running the same stuff while Jokic has been out. It's just a little bit different when, like, the split is Spencer Jones and Peyton Watson instead of, like, Aaron Gordon and Jamal Murray with Jokic at the elbows. It's like, ah, yes, that is going to be a switch more often than not. So that part's going to get tough. But, like, I do think there's some room for some variance in terms of the drives, especially if they are able to get stops and get downhill early. I think they have a little bit more juice with those young guys having that kind of freedom. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just wondering if you had more Denver thoughts or you had a different team you wanted to talk about.
So I was, last thing I'll say on Denver, a lot of zones since Jokic just went out. So if we're talking about defensive answers, if they don't want to go super activity route, keep an eye on the zone. Deron Holmes has been awesome. Short role playmaking has been very good. I like that whenever Denver gets to. Okay. Steve, the Atlanta Hawks. I feel like I spared them last week because we were getting long in a segment. It's like, hey, I see y'all. The defense is back bad. Y'all need to do better. Since then, Trae Young goes down again to get big wins. It's like, ah, well, we're going to start this back again. Trae Young goes down. The defense looks better. They start winning games. Oh, no. Weird losses. They just cannot get a beat on Toronto Raptors, which is a very funny in-season bit, but that's fine. But we now get report. First, Mark Stein, then Shams Charania, then we get Sam Amick. Everyone's kind of circling the wagons on. Trae Young is probably not going to be an Atlanta Hawk by the trade deadline. And on a very general note, it makes me sad that we have gone from Eastern Conference Finals run in 2021 with the Atlanta Hawks, with Trae doing all this, into like the weird season after that, where it's like, you know, kind of bored during the regular season. Everybody's like, what are you talking about? You haven't made the finals yet. What is this? Didn't think it was that big of a deal, but it didn't play well. And now we circle here where he may be getting traded to the Washington Wizards. CJ McCollum is going to be the big salary at the very least coming back at that one, if it is going to be Washington, but nothing final as of recording at the very least. Would be a very dunker spot bid if the trade just breaks during the violet. But so it kind of makes me sad that this is how the Hawks or the trade era is ending in Atlanta. It just felt like a nosedive, like narratively at the very least. And for Trae specifically, I think because of the size and because of some of the effort, to be clear, especially this year, like, there are just limitations to building around a smaller guard if the defense is going to be what it's been for Trae so far this year. Watching the offense over the last year and a half is where I was kind of like, what exactly is this going to be? Because at the high end, Trae Young can knock down pull-up threes from anywhere, lethal floater. If you play him too close, he's getting to the free throw line because of the craft slash grifting. And then he can make any pass in the book. And what's been more consistent over the last year and a half has been the pull-up three-point shooting hasn't really been there, at least in terms of the efficiency. Willing to take them, but that's not down enough. The floater has gone from great to, like, okay. But with the volume that he's taking them at, that's not going to do it. And then you're getting dinged defensively. And so this is where the trade value is now where it is. You're also factoring in this player option that he has for next season. And I'm just like, man, what is this going to be? And so if it is Washington for him in particular, like, I am intrigued by them having an actual organizer to simplify some things for some of the younger players. How the touches get split from there is going to be interesting. Again, if the trade happens, we'll have a deeper dive on that. But I wanted to get some quick thoughts on there. But, like, I'm just kind of sad about the trade era. And then on the flip side, I still don't know exactly who the Hawks want to be, because they have shown such a high level of activity and defense in pockets this season. And then it just all goes away. And then we'll have these lineups sprinkled in where it's like, okay, well, Jalen's on the bench and Nas on the bench and Trae, if he's available, he's on the bench. And it's like, well, okay, who's getting you offense? Like, that can't be the bit. But then you look at the Knicks games. It's like, oh, snap. They held the Knicks to under 100 points in regulation because they have ramped up defensive activity. They told Jalen Brunson, hey, if you're running a ball screen, you are going down one side and one side only, and we're going to see what the offense does from there. And we're going to switch a whole bunch of other stuff, and let's see what your offense does. I don't know what this team is, and I don't know where Trey's going to end up, but all of it is just stressing me out, and it's stressing me out more than it should be.
Shouldn't stress you out. Trae Young is spiritually a Washington Wizard or a Sacramento King, and that's just what's going to happen. And the Kings
are hilarious. They said no. So I'm just...
Then it sounds like he's going to be a Wizard. And the Hawks, hey, got some new wardrobe, took the long road home, changing everything up. Instagram stories look a little different.
That's crazy.
They're happy. I believe Trae Young will remind the world of what he can do going forward. So... That's all I'll say about it right now.
Fair enough, Steve. Did you have another?
Can I talk about the Rockets? Can I talk about their small lineups? That's all I want to talk about. Because look, I know Kevin Durant said, "Hey, Phoenix, you got to get out of here." People got mad about it, but I've been intrigued by Houston mixing these in during the stretch of basketball. And sometimes it was because they wanted to, and other times because they had no other choice. But when you look at a season, you're building towards the playoffs. You're building your identity. Some things you keep in your back pocket. Some things you kind of have to start developing or testing so they can pay off during the playoffs. Lineup versatility is huge, like especially trying to navigate matchup to matchup in the playoffs. You gotta do that. Houston got the double B lineup we talked about earlier in the season. They're trying to figure out what their closing lineup's going to be. And now it's interesting to have this smaller lineup, these smaller lineups back on the table, because that has always felt like one of the sneakier benefits when they added Kevin Durant. And now part of that did feel like Dorian Finney-Smith has returned to our lineup. We kind of need to play him. And boy, we like the contributions we had from our guards and our wings. And oh, all our bigs are out. I get it. And it felt like a quarter ender for Houston. But how good is that group going to be? How many times do you want to employ it? When do you want to employ it? Will that help them in the playoffs? With their size, with their length, with their athleticism, it should open the door for them to switch a whole lot, keep the ball in front, contain, contest, get out and run. And we know Houston is based on defense for the majority. Like, they have an identity. It's been odd to watch that group just kind of be in a weird place. What's the combinations? Who plays together? What are the best options to play together? What does it open up? Because when you go to small lineups or you do different lineups, there's always an attempt. There's a theory. There's an idea. We're trying to do this. But because we're trying to do this, it may open up something that we don't normally deal with on the bad end. So we may elevate a portion, we might open up a new door, we have to figure out how to fix the flaw. One thing I figured out, when Houston goes small, boy, they have got to keep the ball in front. Yeah. That particular group cannot afford to get beat off the bounce and give up dribble penetration. It's not ideal. And it's weird because we know the Rockets are active. We know they work to keep the ball in front, and they feel so much better when there's a big out there. But when they're small and someone gets beat, it's like, oh, paint's wide open, let's go. What are they running offensively when they go small? Reed Shepard, when he's out there with small group, it feels like teams are like, hey, full court pressure, pal, and you're going to have to deal with it. And now he's trying to figure out, okay, there's not really a big to work with in pick and roll. I don't have the automatic chemistry. It might be a switch, so he's figuring that out. And then there are some of the lineups where it's like, okay, who is technically your five? When I say that, I mean, who's your screener? And sometimes you have multiple guys who could, in theory, be best used as the five, but they're all out there together. So it's like Josh Kogi and Tari Eason and Amen Thompson. And the defense is like, well, we're going to guard that guy. And now that guy's the screener. So what do we do there? Is this purely matchup hunting? Like, being able to use Kevin Durant or Amen or Jabari as a screener is fun, but how do we navigate when it's just, oh, we're just going to show and recover, buddy. It's fine. We're not switching this. We're good. What's the next action? Like, when you get the matchup you want, are you ready to make the defense pay? How many people are going to draw a double? Is this opening up drives for Jabari and Amen? Like, what does it do? My concern is, like, a team that plays slow already can be methodical, becomes slow with less size and less purpose. Because that's always been the weird thing I've defended Houston for. They've had purpose with their methodical methods. If you're just going to be slow and it's quick decisions, it gets tricky. The other tricky part is it's still Kevin Durant. And he just at times it doesn't matter because I can make all these shots. I will make all these shots. And it's like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. We're good. So I've just been thinking about what the Houston small lineup theory is going forward.
No, I think that's fair. Like, I have a question to toss your way, but I guess I'll quickly say, I like that Ime is showing a willingness to go to these smaller lineups. And as you mentioned, like, there is some injury context that may be forcing the hand at least a little bit. But I think even heading into the year, we were both talking about, like, hey, what are going to be some of our favorite lineups with this group and things like that. Like, I think we both kind of trended a little smaller with some of ours. And then we also had the, well, they could also just go like four guys above 6'9" if they wanted to, that kind of thing. And so I do think they need that balance, because one of the quiet concern is probably too strong, but one of the quiet thoughts that I've had is last year, I really liked the double big lineup. Heading into this year, I still like the double big lineup. I don't want that to be the only effective counterpunch that they have, though. Especially with them having, you know, going back to last year, like them playing so much zone during those minutes. It's like, okay, I don't want this to be the only thing that like really pops for them as a changeup. Because if that gets dinged, then what are you going to? And that kind of thing. So the fact they're experimenting with the smaller lineups intrigues me. The question I was going to pose to you, as you've mentioned, the different variations that they toss to, do you have a favorite yet? Or do you have like an ideal small ball five for them? Or are you still just kind of gathering information on that front?
I'm gathering still. I mean, I think it should, if we're going to go small, let's have Kevin Durant, let's have Dorian, let's have Amen, let's have Jabari. And then, once again, is it Reed Shepherd or is it Tari Eason?
Duval. No shot. No shot. You know what? Actually, on that point, I don't want to talk about Houston no more. I got some OKC thoughts I want to get off before we move to the next segment. I can't believe you hit us with a darn Duval. You are on one today. Okay, so the Oklahoma City Thunder. Talked about it last week, so I don't want to hang here too long. And the question that I posed to you was more of a big picture thing. Like, hey, they're coming off these three losses to the Spurs. How much of this is the Spurs versus how much can people take from what the Spurs did and replicate? It's like, okay, keeping an eye on what the Jalen Williams creation is going to look like. What exactly is Chet Holmgren going to look like? Some of the old issues popping up, that kind of thing. We talked about it, said, hey, they're still good. They're still my title favorite. All right, what's going on? And so I do still largely feel they're still my title favorite. I'll give that caveat once again. But what I'll say, as the Thunder are now, I think, 6-6 in their last 12 games, is that I'm getting more towards, all right, there are some templates that teams can take from these Spurs matchups. And there are also like some repeatable miscues that I am seeing defensively that's kind of giving me some angst with this Thunder group. Now, impossible for them to turn around? Absolutely not. We've seen the high end of them, et cetera. But I do just kind of want to discuss, especially with them fresh off of the Charlotte game, to where, one, it just feel like the Hornets were just not going to miss threes. But even within that, I am looking at, okay, Charlotte, very comfortable switching against OKC. They are showing a ton of help against anything Shea does. Shea makes the kicks. OKC, once again, not making threes. I was like, ah, we have seen this before. We get to the defensive end, and it's popped in other games, but this Hornets game in particular, it's like, has OKC just never seen double drag before? Like, this has been a historically good defense pretty much all year long. And it's just like, LaMelo brings it up, Con Canipple first screener, Musa Diabate second screener, and they just like, are we navigating this? Are we switching this? Early in the first quarter, Steve, we get Con slipping, Aaron Wiggins is like, hey, Shea, switch this first one, because it's not like Con's going to dive and Musa's going to pop, but hey, just switch this first one, we're going to be good. Shea navigates. And now Chet's just like, okay, who exactly am I supposed to be grabbing here? Con Canipple slips out. Wide open at the left wing. Jalen Williams is defending, I think, Brandon Miller in the corner. He's like, well, we can't have that with the way Con Canipple is shooting the ball. He rotates, quick swing, corner three for Charlotte. I'm just like, well, that can't be the bit. And so you're seeing miscues like that. You're seeing some of the drives that they are allowing, which kind of further reinforces how important drives are for the Thunder on both ends of the floor. If you're cutting off Shea because of all the help that he's seen, if Jalen can't get all the way to the rim consistently, if Chet, as good as the mid-range scoring has been, if he can't get downhill all the way consistently, that's a lot of pressure on A.J. Mitchell to pick up the slack, and he's game for it, but like that's not what you were baking in. You wanted all these guys to hit a wave. That can't be the bit if it's just him. Defensively, the Spurs present unique problems because De'Aaron Fox, Stephon Castle, Dylan Harper, et cetera, can all win drives in a way that kind of neuter some of the perimeter defenders OKC has. Hey, man, if Charlotte's dinging you on drives, that can't be the bit. And then quietly, hey, Shea, not a bad defender. Teams sure are putting you in action more and more these days. And I think, you know, going to the end of the Suns game, I think it's like mostly fine in terms of sliding and contesting, but like it stood out that, no, we want to get to you, big dog. Charlotte, hey, let's see how attentive you are when we put you in action or when we place you on the weak side. Let's see what you want to do. Didn't always pass those tests. And if Shea is getting dinged on that end while also having to carry this ridiculous offensive load, hey, they're talented enough to win. That's not ideal. And it certainly isn't like the 24-1 form that we saw earlier this season. So I'm just like, hey, these are some things that are popping for me right now. And I would like for something to turn. The offensive drive has to be better to give the defense more of a shot to set up, or the defense needs to be better so they can get more transition opportunities to further set that up. So, Rhett.
Fantastic. Did you get all of your OKC Thunder thoughts out?
I think so. I just want to see a little bit better.
Well, like the Thunder, the Dunker Spot will continue to roll. We'll be back after this break with some player thoughts and unrivaled talk.
And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. Steve, it's time to hit the elbow. But want to hit the elbow with one particular player before we get into Unrivaled, and we talk about a whole bunch of players from there. Can I just quickly say, much to your chagrin, I believe, just kidding, but hey, man, Rudy Gobert is like doing positive things in Minnesota once again. The defense remains very strong.
Yeah.
And I think as we kind of zoom out and look at this depoy field, especially with Wimby being so behind in terms of games played, this is not a new, go ahead.
There's no way we're doing this in 2026. there's no chance we're doing this in 2026. There's not a singular chance we're doing this in 2026. There's no one else that we can talk about other than him.
Yes, of course. And we have, like, we mentioned Bam, we mentioned Chet. Like, there are going to be other candidates. I'm not just saying like it is now just Rudy Gobert and nobody else is close. I may end up there by the end of the year, but as of January 6th, like, no, I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that when you factor in the blocks, when you factor in the overall rim deterrence, and teams take a much lower share of shots at the rim when Rudy Gobert is in the game, a lot of that is him. Right. The other part of that is when Rudy goes to the floor, it is a small unit, likely with Julius Randle and Naz Reid, and we'll just say respectfully that teams are a little more willing to go into the paint when that's the front court. So that context matters. But it's yet another year where Rudy's on the floor. We're not really trying to attack the rim like that. When we do go at Rudy, there have been some loud highlights, but you zoom out, teams are shooting 50% at the rim against Rudy Gobert. And among, as I have it in my notes, among 50 players that are defending at least four shots at the rim per game, minimum of 20 games played, that is third in the NBA. Isaiah Stewart is first. Once again, I want him to hit that minutes threshold so he could get on an all-defense team. He has been that good. Chet Holmgren is second. And so, again, I think Chet can factor into this race, presumably he stays healthy. And if OKC turns this kind of mini skirmish around, that's going to be fine. But rim deterrence is there. The rim production is there. And then offensively, Steve.
Oh, we're what? We're doing this on top of it?
I would just like to say.
What would you like to say?
Nearly 72% on twos this year. How's he not going to shoot 72%? He shoots in the paint. Yes, he shoots in the paint. But as we talked about Rudy in the past, there's sometimes been, hey, is he going to catch this pass? And then if he does, we're still asking the question, is he going to catch this pass? I would like to, hold on. Easy, Tiger, as a wise man once said. But there have been, hey, is he going to catch this? And then, hey, what type of shot is he putting up here? Is this going to be one of these weird hooks that he's trying to force up? What's going on here? It's been less of the latter this year, and it's been less of the latter as of late specifically. That's the major thing that I wanted to hit on there. And so that's where he's flirting with a career high in two-point percentage this year. And so that's why I was like, okay, a little bit of refinement there. Some of the passing for Rudy, not going to confuse him with Jokic or anything like that. But keeping things moving, there have been some interesting short roll passes that he's been making as of late. There has been a little bit of refinement there. And for Rudy, to your point, the bar has been low. If it is now consistent competence in that regard, I think that is helpful for this Minnesota Timberwolves offense. And I think we are certainly closer to that in that regard. The screening has always been top tier for Rudy Gobert. That remains the same. And if we're talking about generating extra value, it's a career high in offensive rebounding for him right now. So he's giving you extra opportunities on top of that. I think he's just having a very impactful season for a Minnesota Timberwolves team that is still very good on both ends. As we've talked about, hey, what are they finding offensively? What are they doing against switches? Early in the year, hey, what's going on with the defense? Top 10 in both. They just continue to churn these things out. I just want to quickly salute Rudy Gobert for some of the quiet growth that he's showing.
It's not growth. It's who he is. It's not growth. It's not new. Rudy Gobert is an impactful basketball player. Rudy Gobert comes with an inherent set of problems that people who like to talk about how good Rudy Gobert is never like to discuss. He's a switch defensively against the best teams in the league. If he was a consistent roller, the Wolves would be a top three seed. Unfortunately, when they play the good teams, he's a switch. Because what else is he going to do? And if he was as good at catching the ball as you're saying, he'd be a roll threat. And they'd be even better. Because we've seen him catch the ball and finish and make skip passes. That was the Utah run. He's good on defense. He's fine. He's not answered a single playoff question. I'm so sorry. You said you wanted to have an honest conversation. I feel like I have to deliver this honest message to you. He's been great. Fantastic. Call him an all-star. Vote him for DPOY if you want. Has he answered any of these questions? Do players, no matter how many on-off splits or impact numbers you want to throw, respect him as a defender? Bam Adebayo shot 5 of 13 and said he can't guard me. They don't care. They don't care.
Well, here's what I'd say, Steve. We can transition to Unrivaled. I think you are right in that there is a level of respect that I think you would think with the profile that Rudy has would be a little bit higher, at least on court, that players don't seem to have. I don't think that part necessarily changes the results. As we look at it, like, okay, teams are willing to try to get the poster dunk on Rudy. If he is still thwarting shots at the rim at an elite level, like, how much does that matter?
He's good defensively, and I understand it. But ultimately, it's the undoing every single year. And so you can say it doesn't change the result right now in January of the start of the year. Tell me in April.
I'll say to that point, and then we can boo. To the offense, I do think the offense has been a bigger issue than the defense once we get the playoff time. I do think if Rudy is going to be this consistently great on the offensive glass in particular, because I think when we talk about the switches, you need to score on those or you need to punish smaller defenders on the glass. If he's doing the latter, I do think that goes a long way towards helping to solve that problem. And so eventually we got to get to the playoffs. We'll see. I don't think you said anything unfair, but
Look, man, I'm sorry, but if teams are going to look at Naz Reid and Julius Randle throw wings at them and say, we can switch every Rudy Gobert thing, Minnesota has to figure that out. If they can't figure that out, it'll be Western Conference Finals or semis or bust.
That's tough. That is tough. So, well, there's my Rudy Gobert spiel. I understand your rebuttal. Too unrivaled to close this out, Steve, as I have been fortunate to be in the building. Naturally covered the league last year, but this is my first time on site. The experience is excellent. I would just say the atmosphere is great. The venue, super cool, very intimate setting, but very cool. And as we get into the 4-game slate that we had, because everyone played, it is obviously first game of the season, so I'm not expecting anyone to be in peak form. But my brow was raised quite a few times during the afternoon. And so we start with the Mist beating the Hive, one of the new teams in the league, 72-56. And
Them Mist looking pretty good, listen, buddy.
We talked about it last episode. A little bit beforehand, we talked about the roster. I was like, hey, man, the types of lineups that the Mist can toss out and some of the defensive groupings in particular they can toss out here, when you have Alicia Gray and Breanna Stewart and Veronica Burton and Alana Smith, like any combination of that four,
get super intriguing. And as the Hive, led by Kelsey Mitchell, start that game, the Mists, surprisingly, they start with Veronica Burton, Alicia Gray, Breanna Stewart. The pill switching early, I was like, ah, they're already locked in. That's cool. But anytime Kelsey Mitchell got close to the paint, the convergence of bodies was so brief. Was so quick. It's like, nah.
Hello.
No. Shout out to Atlanta Spoon, who had many a shot challenge in that game. They were just rude defensively. And offensively was more interesting to me because it felt early on in that game, here are all of the Veronica Burton drives. Here's a quick pitch to the wing. Are we going handoff? Maybe not. We can attack there. Second quarter, yeah, they get bogged down because they're like, oh, cool. We're going like Lee plus Stewie. It's kind of like it's the front court there. Hey, how about we just go mismatch hunting right now?
Well, hold on. I'll pause you right there. Number one, Veronica Burton came to play defense in Eurostep. Number two, it was very funny because they went pure post-ups and there was a timeout and they was like, hey, whoever is being guarded by Sanaya, please go to the post, because that's what they did for like 2 to 3 consecutive minutes. And then there was no Sanaya out there. There was 2 bigs. They stopped doing that. So that was a funny bit. But I just want to point that out. The duality of the Mist is pretty tricky because we can just post you up. We can also just go to pick and roll. And we also have Alicia Gray. Hey, would you like to drive left with space?
It was nasty. Like, the Sanaya thing got me because, like, that wasn't the mismatch that they thought it was.
To them, it was.
I mean, yeah. So that's why they kept doing it. But I'm just like, well, here's the stop on Alanis Smith, and here's a strip on Stewie. It's like, hey, even if you're going to go the mismatch hunting route, like, pick somebody else to put on the block versus Sanaya, because she just seems game for it. But then third quarter is like, hey, we're just going to run a bunch of pick and roll. And it was very clear as the Hive were trying to get up to the level. They're trying to throw in some late switches. It's just like, nah. Hear all these pocket passes, you're not going to have a good time. So,
yeah. And not sure they can score. Also, respect Lee Roo. Did you have final laces thoughts?
No, I'll leave that there. But that was very impressive defense performance from the Mist in that one. Then we get the Laces final game, a 58-42 win that was closer than the final score indicated, especially with how that second half went. But, oh boy, I think easily the most physical game of the day. And that was alluded to multiple times in the post-game presses for both teams about the collective physicality of these groups. So I was intrigued there. And I think with the Laces, it's more so tracking, like, okay, where exactly are these shots coming from? And how aggressive does everyone want to be? I think Jackie Young came out like, oh, I'm taking all these pull-ups. And then here are some flashy passes on top of that. Like, there was, didn't end up in anything. But there was like a behind-the-back entry, post-entry pass. I was like, oh, Jackie is continuing to feel different. That's neat. Brittany Sykes eventually, I think in the second half, said, okay, her and Erica Wheeler going back and forth, one of the funniest subplots of that basketball game. But she took it over. Alyssa Thomas, one shot attempt in the first half. And I think someone must have told her that at the half. She immediately went to the block and started getting more aggressive. So that part's cool. I think the defense is going to be firm from them pretty much all year long. It's just, okay, what exactly is the shot creation against which it's going to look like there? And I think with the vinyl, oh, actually, do you have any Laces thoughts before I get to them?
No, continue. Okay. Oh, continue. Okay.
My apologies. I think with the vinyl, it's more so, it's similar a bit, honestly, with the offense. Like, what types of shots are you generating? Like, I think there's a baked-in level of Courtney Williams plus De'Erica Hamby, and pick and roll should generate some good stuff. If it's a switch, Courtney can boogie. De'Erica Hamby didn't have the finishing game that we are accustomed to, but like is one of the better interior scores that we have in unrivaled in W overall. So I expect that to be better moving forward. With Ryan, I think with her getting a lot of Brittany Sykes on her to begin with, like, distracting, how often are you driving? Because that's kind of my big picture question with Ryan Howard. So we shift to, like, W thoughts. Like, how often can you access the paint? I think she made some strides last year as a foul drawer and as a driver overall. It felt kind of light on that end in day one, so I'm going to continue to track that part. But the defense is one today in this one for me.
The Laces second unit felt a little ahead offensively than the first unit, but AT got aggressive when it counted, and Jackie Young is tough to deal with. I think the vinyl are going to be very competitive, but they will have to figure out how to move the ball.
Okay, I think that's fair. We get to the Rose BC Lunar Isles game. The Rose BC getting their banner raised before the game, which is very nice.
Yeah. Hootie who, indeed, right?
So, like, on the non-basketball front, we did just have some genuine antics between Marina Bavery and Shug Sutton. And that really permeated in the second half as Marina's like, all right, well, bet, I'm here now. The stare downs after every basket were hilarious. But I think for the Rose, oh boy, Asbury Stevens shot out of a cannon in that first quarter. A lot of drives for her, which I was intrigued and talked about this in kind of the lead up to the season. Like, how aggressive would she be in light of the roster shifting just a little bit? And they ultimately didn't have Kalia Copper in this game either. She was up for the challenge. It was a lot more aggressive. Chelsea Gray was just insane on both ends of the floor. 35 to lead all scores for just day one of Unrivaled, for one. But it's mid-range pull-ups, it's drives, it's deep threes. Like, when she had that run in the second quarter where I'm just gonna dribble up the floor and take a deep three and see what you do about it. And it's like, oh yeah, this game is over. I think it was like 25-9 after one. They're so good. And once you get Chelsea Gray, hey, let's try to get a bigger player on her. We have a mismatch. No, you don't. She was one of the best post defenders in the W last year. Is a similar bit and unrivaled right now. Three steals in the box score, but many more deflections off of someone's knee. So it's a turnover, but it's not a steal for her. She was just locked in. I think it was overall a balanced effort, but Azare and Chelsea were definitely the high marks for me.
I think that it was a contrast because, one, how did the Rose just basically keep the majority of the same roster? And said, well, we don't have Brittany Sexton, here's Shug Sutton, and we don't have Angel Reese, so here's Shakira Austin. And they were just about the business. I looked at the Lunar Owls, and like, there's Skylar Diggins-Smith and Fee on the bench, and that's Marina Mabry and Rebecca Allen. And they're just going to find a way to get back to the spirit of the Hootie Who. But, yeah, the Rose are about that
they're
action.
They're about also. That action. Again, no Skylar, as you mentioned. I think Fee is done for the Unrivaled season, naturally, as she recovers from the double ankle injury. Or surgery, rather. But they should be getting Skylar back at some point, and they are going to need her drives. So I was looking at the offense, like, I still like the concepts that you are running. It is just that we are comfortable switching all of this. And if there is space, we are still we are fine with, like, collapsing. Until we get to the fourth quarter and they play Marina and Rachel Bannon together, it's like, huh, you might need that three-point shooting. I think there was a point where Lunar Owls had taken, I think, 12 threes. Like, thinking like late second, early third. They had taken 12 threes and Marina had taken like 9 of them. I was like, that can't be the split. Someone's got a helper on that in that regard. And she alluded to that.
Taxes and the guy that's not enjoying Marina Mabry's shot selection.
I will say the half court pull, I was like, oh, she's really feeling it. And then end of the second quarter where she goes early and took one and missed. I was like, wait, why did she take that one? But no. She ultimately turned it up in the second half against her plus Shug Sutton just int. That was fun. But shout out to Rose BC. And then the final game of the night, Steve. We got the Breeze. We got the Phantom. 7-point win for the Breeze in that one. I think Paige Beckers is going to be very good in this format. That is my hot take for the evening. Because good gracious, her usage was fun. It wasn't just high pick and roll stuff for her. They got her off ball as well. And just watching her reads, and as we get to the end of that game, as the Phantom, also very physical. It was a physical game for both of those. But we get to that fourth quarter, and it's like, okay, cool. Are we at the level? Are we dropping into late switch? Okay, now we're just going to trap her because we don't know what to do right now because she is making shots and also making all the reads on top of that. It was kind of cool to see how quickly she was able to dictate terms in this setup. And this is with Phantom BC ultimately playing well. I will say, and I tweeted out during the game, they really miss Satu in this matchup because once Rakia, who sprinkled in some interesting pick and roll possessions during this game as well, once you get to the Rakia portion, it's like, okay, we're either going to have a guard on her and they are just going to spam post-ups, or if we size up, there's going to be a big on her and that can unlock some things too. It's like, yeah, they don't have, as good as the Phantom are, like, they don't have like the mid-size player. It is small guards. No Dana in this one, but like in theory, you still have Kelsey Plum, you have Dana Evans, you have Tiffany Hayes, excuse me. And then we have bigs. We got Kiki, we got Aaliyah. Who's the wing? And so that's going to be something that I track while Satu is out. But entertaining game nonetheless. Great with Kevin.
One, Kelsey Plum did everything you thought Kelsey Plum would do. and unrivaled. So salute to that. Two, good to see Cam bring back on the court. The volleyball-esque rebound at the free throw line that she had in the third quarter, where I don't really know how she managed to get a backhand on that, was fantastic. I don't know what to do with Paige in this setting. And like Paige and Kate Martin and Cam bring out there just annoying people for minutes at a time, like can't break play and drop, be like, actually I'll block your shot and then we'll run on the other end and we'll keep playing like that. The breeze and the mist are, they were made for me.
Those would be two fun ones.
They speak to my basketball spirit. Okay.
I like it. Two game setup on Friday, so we'll be tapping in with some more thoughts next week. We're gonna be recording before those set of games happen, of course, but fun opener. Excited to be there on Friday night, and ultimately I'm thankful, Steve. I am thankful. Thankful for you.
Man, that warms my heart. I'll talk about Annie.
You know, on that note, thank you, or I'm sorry, for listening to or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe. You know, just press the plus 15 if you want to hear what Steve just did. But, you know, please subscribe. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Also, we are on the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel, so please subscribe.
Subscribe if you haven't already. Tell a friend to subscribe to the new Yahoo Sports NBA YouTube channel. Don't miss out on what we cook up.
What is that? Please subscribe. You can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve at your own peril at Steve Jones 20. With that, we will catch y'all later in the week.